Here they come. Right now, they're gathering from hospitals all across America for Talk 10 Tuesday. They know there's important news and information just ahead. Don't miss out. Come in, sit down, and log on. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and co-host Dr. Erica Reamer. Here now is the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, Chuck Buck.
Thank you, Clyke Anthony. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 404th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday, brought to you today by ICD University. And joining me this morning as my co-host is the very, very popular Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer is the founder and the president of Erica Reamer, MD, Incorporated. And good morning, Erica.
Thank you, Chuck, and good morning, everyone.
This morning, our lead story is about price transparency. It's in the news again. Last week, the Health Information Technology Advisory Committee voted to include price transparency as an immediate focus in its proposed task to the government.
That's right. But the real question is whether Trump's executive order will ever go into effect. There's a lawsuit by the American Hospital Association to block the president's price transparency rule.
And so there's a lot of confusion surrounding price transparency. The good news, of course, is nationally recognized professional physician coder and auditor Terry Fletcher. She's going to join us later in the broadcast to report on what she's hearing from policy experts.
Yeah, that is good news. And Susan Gatehouse will report the difference between extravasation and infiltration and why it's important for coders to know the difference.
It's also important for coders to know about the Coordination Domains Committee meeting. It's scheduled for Tuesday and Wednesday, March 17th and 18th. Lori Johnson is going to provide us with an update on this upcoming meeting.
And Lori also will continue her reporting on the deadly coronavirus. South Korea announced last week its first death from the new virus.
And you have a talkback, Civic. What are you going to be talking about this morning?
I'm going to be challenging you all to do an educational exercise.
Ooh, wow. Sign me up for that. We have much news to report, and we begin this morning with Grant Huang, who's at the Talk 10 Tuesday news desk.
The Talk 10 Tuesday news desk is sponsored by ICD University Bookstore, reminding you that Dr. Erica Reamer's CDI learning modules for providers are now available. Use the ICD-10 Monitor Resources tab at the top of the web room for more information.
Here now is Grant Huang.
Thanks, Chuck. Even as a major change to outpatient evaluation and management, or E&M codes, looms next year, a change that would reduce the documentation burden on providers, commercial insurance companies are cracking down this year on E&M services. United Healthcare, one of the largest health insurers nationwide, has begun targeting all claims with level 4 and 5 E&M codes, rejecting large numbers of such claims. A specialty practice in St. Louis, Missouri, had approximately 350 claims for level 4 and 5 E&M codes flagged between November and January, with United Health giving the group 5 calendar days to upload the medical records or see the claims denied. As the practice's staff rush to upload the records, a difficult case in some cases because the deadline doesn't account for weekends, United Health began denying many of the claims after reviewing the records, stating that they did not meet medical necessity requirements. Not the first time United Health has targeted high-level E&M codes. In March of 2018, the insurer launched a similar initiative against emergency department or ED visits. Under that policy, UHC targeted hospitals submitting the two highest-level E&M codes for the ED setting, denying or downcoding the claims. At the time, UHC stated that it was using a software module developed by its subsidiary Optum to audit these codes. The tool worked by looking at a patient's diagnoses, comorbidities, and diagnostic tests ordered during the episode to determine if the code was supported. This isn't the only aggressive movement targeting E&M services over the past year. Cigna, another major private insurer, recently unveiled a new audit initiative that it simply calls the Evaluation and Management Coding Program. It appears to be a data mining expedition targeting almost all outpatient and inpatient E&M services. Cigna will examine E&M utilization outliers by specialty and geographic area, reviewing E&M coding patterns over time. While Cigna does not explicitly say it will issue denials, it will try to improve affordability, and it is also emphasizing that this program is focused on education and outreach. It says that in cases, quote, when E&M results demonstrate consistently higher outlier utilization, a Cigna market medical executive may also contact the healthcare provider. This outreach may include a telephone call, a meeting request, or a discussion initiated during a meeting scheduled for another purpose. In rare cases, a chart review may be requested and performed, And the goal is to help educate healthcare providers about improving their coding practices. However, both of these efforts are occurring during the last year when providers are operating under the current E&M documentation guidelines, which date back to 1995 and 1997. Remember that in next year, the CPT changes will take place that reduce documentation requirements with respect to the history and exam components for evaluation and management services. With that, I'll throw it back to Chuck.
Thanks, Grant. Grant was substituting this morning for Tim Powell. Grant is a senior healthcare consultant with Doctors Management. This is Tuesday, it's February the 25th, and you're listening to the 404th live edition of Talked In Tuesday. Stand by.
Elevate the accuracy and integrity of your ICD-10-CM coding by recognizing the red flags that represent risk. Red flags mean non-compliant ICD-10-CM coding practices that create a high risk for investigations, penalties, and payer recoupments. Recognizing the flags is the first step in taking preventative and corrective steps to ensure full compliance, which means protection for your bottom line. In an upcoming ICD-10 Monitor webcast, Glorianne Bryant will offer action steps for ensuring accurate, fully compliant ICD-10-CM coding. Register now for Red Flags and High Risks, Part 2, ICD-10-CM Coding. The webcast is Thursday, March 5th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. To register, use the upcoming webcast tab in today's broadcast and save $25 when you enter the coupon code Tuesday.
Here now with the Talked In Tuesday Coding Report is Lori Johnson. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Erica, and hello to our listeners. I have several updates with regards to the coronavirus, which the WHO has not declared a pandemic as of yet. First is a reminder that we talked about the new HCPCS code for the testing for the coronavirus last week. The code is U0001, which will be valid on April 1st, 2020, and is applicable to dates of service February 4th and later. Second is the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped, or I'm sure some people would say plunged, 1,000 points due to concerns over the virus impacting international trading. The White House is expected to request up to $2.5 billion to address the response to the coronavirus. In the U.S., 426 people have been tested for the virus with 12 positive results, and those are related to people traveling in the risky areas. Two people have tested positive, which was a result of person-to-person spread, and U.S. citizens have returned from Wuhan, China, or were aboard the Diamond Princess cruise ship, 39 of those people have tested positive. The CDC has published travel guidance for people that want to travel to China, and their suggestion is to avoid non-essential travel. They've published guidance for Japan, South Korea, and Hong Kong, and said that you should practice usual enhanced precautions. And if you're planning an Asian cruise, you should reconsider that option. The FDA has taken steps to ensure quality of foreign products. The agency is providing oversight for products brought in from China. And as of yesterday, there's been 77,362 cases that have been reported with the coronavirus with 2,618 deaths. The new cases in China have begun to decline, which is encouraging. There are some recent increasing number of cases in Iran, South Korea, and Italy, which is a concerning fact that has occurred. This subject can be followed on the CDC and WHO websites, and I encourage you to use these websites for accurate information regarding the current status. So, Erica, back to you.
Thanks, Lori. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is a senior healthcare consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC.
Our Tuesday focus centers around an important question for coders and, in fact, everybody in healthcare. And the question is, what's the difference between extravasation and infiltration? Susan Gatehouse joins us now to explain why it's important to know the difference.
Thank you, Chuck, and good morning, all. So what is the difference between infiltration and extravasation, other than the difficulty in pronouncing that word? Both are considered IV solutions or medications leaking into surrounding tissue during IV therapy. It's a type of solution or medication that is inadvertently delivered into the surrounding tissues that determines the difference. So both infiltration and extravasation are considered forms of IV therapy. The solution that is used during IV therapy that may leak into surrounding tissue, again, differentiates the two. Infiltration is caused by the administration of a non-vesicant agent into the vein, which may leak into surrounding tissue. This can cause pain, redness, swelling. Most often, it's considered very minor in nature. Extravasation refers to the unintentional administration of a vesicant agent into the surrounding tissue. These are active chemical substances that can cause blistering, in extreme cases, necrosis. It's not uncommon for a patient to receive a local injection of a reversal agent if extravasation occurs. If left untreated, the patient may suffer major complications to the affected area. Doctors often use these terms interchangeably. Again, the essential difference between the two is type of medication that is used during IV therapy. So vesicant and non-vesicant agents, the two classes of IV solutions. However, vesicant agents are highly reactive chemicals that cause cellular level changes resulting in serious complications. Some common examples of vesicant medications include vancomycin, potassium chloride, calcium gluconate, and those are just to name a few. This type of documentation or level of documentation may not always be accessible to coders. It is important to leverage all coding resources to obtain an accurate diagnosis because this particular diagnosis does code or transfer to a complication code, which we all try to avoid because of quality measures. So definitely tap into resources such as your pharmacy is a great resource to tap into. So it is important for us to know the codes for these two conditions are part of the National Database for Nursing Quality Indicators. In keeping with the expanding complexities of coding and the direct effect codes have on quality, more than ever before, coders must utilize critical thinking skills and all available resources. With that said, back to you, Erica.
Thank you, Susan. I must confess, I did not know the difference between extravasation and infiltration before you brought it to our attention today. That was Susan Gatehouse. Susan is the founder and CEO of Axia Solutions. Chuck?
And you can read Susan's report on this very important subject in today's ICD-10 Monitor News. Our special report this morning is about the upcoming Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting. It's scheduled for Tuesday and Wednesday, March 17 and 18th. Here now with a preview of what to expect this year is Laurie Johnson once again.
Good morning, Chuck, again. The Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting meets in March and September each year to review new code and new code revision proposals. It is a joint meeting involving the CDC and CMS. The process for creating a new code is that an organization or an individual identifies the need. Second step is to complete the application to the Coordination and Maintenance meeting. The applications are reviewed and applicants are notified regarding the decision to proceed, meaning they will be able to present or their application has been rejected. The first step is a presentation at the coordination and meeting, and the presentation should include clinical rationale and code alternatives. The CNM meeting is a public meeting which encourages commentary. After the meeting, the CDC will consider and finalize diagnosis options, while CMS will review and finalize inpatient procedure options. Final determinations are not made at the actual live meeting. The next meeting is March 17th and 18th, as Chuck said, with procedures presented first, followed by the diagnosis. The meeting will be broadcasted through CMS, and the dial-in is 1-855-829-8848, and the meeting ID is 731-253-409. And you don't have to memorize or have written that down. We've provided a little tab for you that has all the information on it. And that number, that dial-in number, will be good for both days. If you plan to attend in person, you must register by March 6, 2020. If you are only listening, there is no need to register. The information is posted in the CNM tab, as we said before, and you can use that for your information. There are 23 items on the procedure agenda, and I'm not going to read them all. You can read them in the agenda. But it's intramedullary joint fusion system, which is a new type of device. And then there's a number of items under the administration of medicine, such as Terlivaz, Nuzyra, Zenlita, Zerbaxa, KTE X19. There's some testing items for syndromic infectious disease testing for pneumonia or phenotypic antimicrobial susceptibility testing. They will also have new devices that will be presented. There's the Section X update, which is new technology, and the addenda. So that's for the procedure. So the procedure meeting looks pretty busy. The diagnosis agenda is considerably smaller, as there are 11 items, including anaplasmosis, the coronavirus disease, which we've talked about here, and whatever they suggest must be consistent with the WHO version of ICD-10. Cough, the electronic nicotine delivery devices, which I think is going to be linked to EVALI and those codes, endometriosis, non-ischemic myocardial injury, pediatric feeding disorder, personal history of chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy, vaping-related disorder, the EVALI. If you remember, U07.0 has been proposed as a code to be effective for 1-2020. Synthetic cannabinoids, and the ICD-10-CM addenda. So it looks like it's going to be an active year with regards to ICD and changes that are upcoming. So back to you, Erica.
Well, you know, I can't wait for it. Thanks again, Lori. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is a senior healthcare consultant at Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC.
As we mentioned at the top of the broadcast, there's a real question as to whether President Trump's executive order on hospital price transparency will take effect. So naturally, there's confusion surrounding price transparency. So for some clarity on this issue, nationally recognized professional physician coder and auditor Terry Fletcher now joins us to report on what she's hearing from policy experts. So good morning, Terry. What are you hearing?
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everyone. Well, like you said, there are many reports regarding the healthcare transparency rule. As a reminder, on November 15, 2019, the Trump administration proposed a new healthcare price transparency rule that would basically require hospitals to explain how much a medical service would cost before a patient receives treatment. And this rule is due to become effective January 2021. The Institute of Medicine defines healthcare transparency as making available to the public in a reliable and understandable manner information on the healthcare system's quality, efficiency, and consumer experience with care, which includes price and quality data, so as to influence the behavior of the patients. Under the hospital price transparency rule, hospitals must publish their standard charges online and in a machine-readable format. In theory, price transparency, in addition to access to information about quality, should enable patients to shop for the most effective, low-cost healthcare available. It also should drive prices down as healthcare providers compete for market share. However, as Chuck said, there has been pushback from several groups, including the AHA, saying the rule is seen as violation of the First Amendment by the hospital groups because it also demands confidential information on individually negotiated contract terms with all third-party payers, including private commercial health insurers. They have to publish in an open internet platform. Some U.S. hospital groups have also challenged the Trump administration's rule that requires them to be more transparent, and this was according to a lawsuit filed again back in November. Their position is that such disclosures would eliminate hospitals' ability to negotiate pricing with insurers, and that would undermine competition and incentives for health insurers to sign arrangements that could potentially lower costs. However, the Department of Health and Human Services, they're really not buying into this position. And their spokeswoman, Caitlin Oakland, was quoted saying hospitals should be ashamed that they aren't willing to provide American patients the cost of a service before they purchase it. She also added that the administration would continue to fight for price transparency. If this rule is held up in the court system, app developers will go crazy developing tools for patients, and patients will use those tools in search for the best deals. The goal is to give the public availability of prices that will hopefully shame high-priced hospitals into lowering their prices because they'll be so embarrassed. It's about competition and free market. Patients should at least be given the information as they would any goods or services that they purchase. However, the industry people that I've reached out to believe very strongly that we wouldn't see much of a benefit to patients from more healthcare pricing data being available. In fact, they didn't expect much effect at all. This actually surprised me. Their thoughts were that most people do not shop for lower-cost healthcare services, even when pricing information is made available to them. But my question was, when is it made available? My personal experience is when I went to schedule an MRI recently for my shoulder, I had to have it done in the hospital for my insurance purposes. I spent hours and actually days trying to get the actual price of the test, but could not get anyone to tell me the actual price, only a guesstimate of my share of cost. Finally, after a few days of research, I found out the hospital MRI was $3,200, but the diagnostic imaging center down the street was only $850. The interesting part is my copay would have been the same at $50. The hospital didn't understand my issue and wanting to know the exact price because my out-of-pocket was the same. But think about that for the cash patient with no insurance, a 26% higher cost if done in the hospital. So with all of this chest beating and posturing, what actually happens if the hospitals don't comply? Well, they'll have to pay a penalty instead, which would dampen the impact of the policy itself. The fine for noncompliance is $300 a day, which is really peanuts for the hospitals with nine-figure budgets or higher. Then again, hospitals may also not want to purposely violate federal regulation. That wouldn't bode well for them down the road. But let's assume the hospitals provide the data. What's that can happen? Well, the fear for the Trump plan is that making more information available to patients, this could actually end up raising costs. Certain researchers have said that the more expensive or patients assume more expensive doctors is higher quality care, just like in concierge medicine. Another concern could be that hospitals would just raise their prices. Right now, a hospital might offer one insurer a lower price than another because one hospital or one insurer has more patients. So rather than having to risk having to change their pricing, they might just raise their prices. The most likely scenario is that the penalty would just be enforced should a hospital defy the rule and they would just pay the $300 a day fine. I mean, again, this is very weak and I just see them paying it. But that being said, there is widespread bipartisan support for requiring healthcare providers to disclose pricing information. In fact, healthcare price transparency is an area that nearly 90% of registered voters can get behind, a truly nonpartisan issue. Because of innovators like Amazon and Lyft, American consumers know the value of and expect on-demand, price-transparent, customer-related, and centered services. The healthcare industry can no longer be exempt from these standards. So stay tuned for more updates. Erica, back to you.
Thank you, Terry. That was nationally recognized professional physician, coder, and auditor, Terry Fletcher. Chuck?
And you can read Terry Fletcher's exclusive report on price transparency in today's ICD-10 Monitor News. Now's the time for our popular segment here at Talked In Tuesday. It's called Talk Back, and it features our own Dr. Erica Reamer.
Today's Talk Back is sponsored by ICD University Bookstore, reminding you that the 2020 Essentials for Clinical Documentation Integrity Handbook is now available. Order yours today.
Here now is Dr. Erica Reamer.
All right, Chuck. Today I am making a pitch for reciprocal education. To set the stage, I am doing a really fun, intellectually challenging ongoing project.
I compose multiple choice questions on a really slick platform called Dosed Daily for a payer organization to improve and standardize their review processes. The participants get a single multiple choice question daily, and on Fridays they get a longer case-based question in three parts. Truth be told, someday I really want to flip it around and educate emergency physicians and hospitalists to optimize their status determining skills. I think this vehicle would be superlative for teaching CDI to providers too, but I digress. To design an effective multiple choice question, one has to research the topic to know what the current evidence-based standard of practice is. Then you need to ascertain what the knowledge gap of your participant is and determine what they need to know to change their behavior and achieve the intended outcome. You have to figure out what factoids you want them to learn from this question, and they should learn as much from the wrong choices as the right one. I spend a lot of time pondering how I can make the participant have to think. I don't want the correct answer to be so obvious that anyone could guess it. For instance, I wouldn't just say, "Gee, I bleed," with my outside voice. I would offer black tarry stools with epigastric pain instead. I craft patient scenarios which set the stage for asking thoughtful questions, and then I may vary some of the features to pose the same question with different clinical indicators. The explanations as to why A is the correct choice and B through D were wrong is where the participants hopefully expand their knowledge base. You have to make the explanations clear, concise, and edifying. This platform is meant to be quick, interesting, short aliquots of information which move the needle and improve the organizational metrics. The really fun part is that I learn a tremendous amount in the process. I was researching anemia and discovered that tonic water had been the cause of my father's chronic thrombocytopenia. Did you know that pagophagia is the excessive eating of ice seen in pica from iron deficiency anemia? It goes away as soon as iron therapy is initiated, often before there is any observable hematologic response. How cool is that? And the word pica comes from the genus containing the omnivorous magpie. So here's my pitch. I want to challenge you to create a question for your colleagues about whatever it is that you do. Whether you are in compliance or coding or CDI or you do medical necessity, find some interesting point that you think your work friends could benefit from learning. Google a question you have and read an article. That is how you will find related information to serve as the other choices. Don't make it a true or false binary choice. Find three other points which complement the first fact. It may be three false choices and one true one, or vice versa. Then type out the explanation as to why the right answer is right and the others are wrong. You could even ask your buddies to make their own questions too. You could teach each other new information or reinforce best practice. You could dose your questions daily or weekly. If we stop learning, we stagnate. This will be a fun way for you and your colleagues to grow your knowledge base. If you enjoyed this exercise, feel free to email your questions to us at cbuck@medlearnmedia.com. I'd love to learn from you. Who knows? Maybe I will share your question in a future talkback or a listener survey. Chuck, back to you.
Thanks, Erica, very much. That's very, very interesting. We've asked our panelists to stick around for a couple of questions that have come in, so let me begin. Erica, please ask Susan that question that came in from one of our listeners a few minutes ago.
Sure. Susan, someone asked us, could you give us the difference in the codes between extravasation and infiltration?
Oh, sure. Great question. So I would refer a coder to category T82, which would, obviously, there are additional digits that would be applied depending on the documentation, the record, and the episode of care. That category specifically relates to complications with vascular infusion catheters. So under your index, you would look for complication, IV infusion, and take it from there in accordance with the documentation and the record.
So T82.9 and then XXXX. And the thing that you have to be clear about is this is a complication, and there really probably is no way to get around that because this is not something, you know, that should generally happen in routine practice. So if it happens, there should be a complication code for it.
Great response, Erica, and thank you, Susan, for answering that question. And that is going to be a wrap for our 404th live edition of Tucked In Tuesday, and I want to thank our panelists today. Terry Fletcher, Susan Gatehouse, Grant Huang, Lori Johnson, and of course, our co-host, Dr. Erica Reamer. And remember, you can listen to all the Talk 10 Tuesday podcasts anytime, anywhere, on any device, and it's free. Until next Tuesday, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for ICD-10 Monitor and Talk 10 Tuesday. Thank you very much for being with us.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.